did take up a simple build, and you know, people try to hijack it and put something on there, and a lot of mischief happens.
The legislature enters day 93 with no scheduled meetings and no adjournment. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, April 22nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a land transfer that may allow Galena to relocate.
It's a good idea. More and more people are going to move out there. And a lot of people around here say, why didn't we build out there in the first place?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
Earn a Master of Public Administration from the University of Alaska Southeast online on your schedule while having the structure of the classroom and the accessibility of e-learning. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
The legislature blew past its adjournment deadline on Sunday. All but one committee meeting scheduled since then has been canceled or delayed indefinitely. Now Governor Bill Walker is calling on lawmakers to do work on bills for as long as it continues to be in session. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
In a letter sent to Senate President Kevin Meyer and House Speaker Mike Chenault on Wednesday, the governor urged them to use this time wisely and suggested they continue to work on Medicaid reform and expansion. He also asked the legislature to make progress on three specific pieces of legislation: a bill advancing an interior energy project, a bill dealing with the state's child support program, and a bill known as Aaron's Law that would establish a sexual abuse prevention program in schools. In an interview in the Capitol stairwell, Senate President Kevin Meyer said one of the reasons bills were not being heard was that his caucus hopes a deal will be struck on the budget that will allow them to adjourn soon. The Anchorage Republican also said he wants to limit legislative gamesmanship and cited an effort by Senate Democrats on Tuesday to roll Aaron's Law into a bill establishing Children's Day.
When we did take up a simple bill, then you know, people try to hijack it and put something on there, and a lot of mischief happens. So we might be better off, if mischief's going to occur, not to hear any more bills.
Meyer also said the Senate has met its constitutional obligation to pass an operating budget and that its agenda for the session is complete. Meyer blamed the adjournment delay on House Democrats, who are trying to secure more education funding at a time when the state faces a multi-billion dollar deficit. But he also said if lawmakers cannot make a deal on the budget within the next few days, they may consider holding committee hearings again.
The Senate feel like we've finished our work and we're ready to go home. Boxes are packed. We feel guilty, too, about using getting paid a per diem for being here because we want to be home and our work is done. But again, we're kind of held hostage here by the other side because they can't get an agreement. So if it looks like that agreement can't be reached anytime soon, then yeah, let's just keep working.
House Speaker Mike Chenault said his caucus would likely restart committee hearings on Wednesday. He also noted that the House has acted on all of the governor's specific requests, save for Medicaid expansion.
You know, the House has already passed three of the bills that the governor's talking about.
More than 300 bills have been introduced this legislative session, but just 36 have passed both chambers. Lawmakers will be collecting an additional $13,000 in per diem for every day the legislature goes beyond its statutory deadline. While the legislature is on day 93 of its 90-day statutory session, it can meet for up to 121 days as provided by the Alaska Constitution. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Senator Dan Sullivan added an amendment to the human trafficking bill the U.S. Senate passed today. Sullivan says it addresses a problem he faced as Alaska's Attorney General.
The key goal of this amendment is to enable the resources and cooperation between state and federal prosecutors to ensure all cases of human trafficking are pursued and victims have justice.
In 2010, the Justice Department decided it would not pursue charges against VECO founder Bill Allen for allegedly having sex with underage girls. Sullivan says the feds also refused his request to let state prosecutors press charges under the Federal Mann Act, which makes it a crime to transport people across state lines for illegal sex. The amendment Sullivan added to the Senate bill today says the U.S. Attorney General has to grant requests to cross-designate state prosecutors to handle Mann Act charges or to explain why that would undermine the administration of justice. Bill Allen, once a big contributor to primarily Republican candidates in Alaska, was the government's key witness in a prosecution of Senator Ted Stevens on corruption charges. Allen served 11 months in prison for bribery and other crimes. He finished his probation last year. It's unclear whether Allen could still face charges under the Mann Act. The Yukon River community of Galena could be relocated out of flood danger if a land transfer being pursued by Alaska Congressman Don Young goes through. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the village, which is still recovering from a major flood 2 years ago, will likely approach moving with multiple steps over time.
Representative Don Young advocated for transfer of U.S. Air Force land on higher ground above the Yukon River to the city of Galena during testimony before the House Armed Services Committee last week.
This area has been actually abandoned. It's still maintained by the Air Force, but very frankly, they don't have any objection if we can transfer to the city of Galena. It costs nothing to the taxpayer. It will save the city.
The former site of the Air Force's Campion radar station, about 6 road miles from Galena, would provide a location safe from severe floods, like the spring breakup deluge that inundated the village 2 years ago. Galena Mayor John Korda says Campion would likely initially be a site for a subdivision for residents who want to build homes above the floodplain.
I don't think we're talking about a wholesale relocation of the community. I mean, we're certainly not talking about that. I'm envisioning something that would play out over time.
Korda says if the land transfer goes through and utilities can be extended to the site, it could become a viable and appealing spot for the community.
As infrastructure is replaced, you know, if it's a good idea, more and more people are going to move out there. And I mean, a lot of people around here say, why didn't we build out there in the first place?
Korda adds that the appetite for relocation to Campion will likely hinge on the frequency of major floods.
You know, historically, we've flooded every 30, 40 years, and that's probably just far enough apart that people can deal with it. But if we get a couple, you know, close together events, I think people would look at that real seriously.
The road to Campion sustained damage in the 2013 flood, but has since been upgraded. Korda says Campion is the site of the city landfill, which would likely have to be relocated if people move to the area. He says there's also hazardous waste contamination dating from the military's use of the area that would have to be worked around. Congressman Young wants the land transfer included in the 2016 National Defense Authorization Act. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a southeast community looks for a better way to test for PSP toxin.
Here we are living with hundreds of bears that wander through the street and everybody's scared of the clams.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
If you are a teenager in Anchorage struggling with homelessness, hunger, or addiction, there are few places to turn. All week, we've been hearing about a wide gap between early exposure to drugs and alcohol and the crises that bring people into treatment, part of our series called The Blind Spot. KSKA's Zachariah Hughes visited one of the few organizations in Anchorage helping at-risk teens on their own terms, hidden in plain sight in one of the city's busiest buildings.
The Power Teen Center is up a flight of stairs in the hectic downtown transit center.
And right now we're standing kind of like a balcony where you can kind of look over and see everyone downstairs waiting for their bus.
Kalizia is 17 and has been employed as an outreach worker at Power, which is what everyone I talk to calls it, for going on 3 years. She gave me a tour one Friday, close to 5 p.m., as the staff are closing up for the weekend, ushering dozens of young people out the door.
This is the front center, pretty much where people hang out, watch TV, and also where like people can get the sign-in or the clipboard to get tested to see the nurse. And then also we have the condom giraffe in here. But yeah, condom giraffe, and then people just sit out here and chill and talk, pretty much.
Condom giraffe, I should mention, is a giraffe-shaped cabinet stocked with condoms for clients to take. Power offers basic services like food and clothing, and connects at-risk kids to resources like housing, counseling, and even treatment. Last year, the on-site medical clinic tested more than 400 young people for sexually transmitted diseases. Paid youth staffers like Kalizia work here, but they also carry backpacks full of food and supplies, doing street outreach downtown or by the park strip and as far away as the Diamond Center. Chris Mortensen is one of the few adults I see during my visit. He supervises the center and its staff and thinks Power's model fills a vital gap in services available to young people.
I mean, I think that we're much more on the side of safety and linkage as far as being the first line of contact. So we use a harm reduction model, meaning that we're not going to kick out youth because of them using or because of different difficulties that they may have, you know, trying to look past some of the barriers for them to reach other services.
As Mortensen and I are talking inside the food pantry, a young man pokes his head in.
Can I get a bag of food?
Absolutely, yeah.
He fills a plastic bag with dry goods and a package of lunch meat from a freezer. Power's approach is similar to the Housing First model, which believes you can't help people in crisis with big life issues if immediate concerns like hunger and safety aren't met. Mortensen says that's part of the reason the center is located in the bus station.
Our youth are here. Whether we're here or not, our youth are downstairs and hanging out here. One of my youth peer outreach workers the other day told me, you know, Chris, just because we're not open on Mondays doesn't mean our youth aren't outside sitting against the glass door.
Kalizia is more candid about how the location fits with the mission. Many of the clients she works with are surviving poverty, addiction, and trauma, with the geography of downtown and the bus system playing a prominent role.
Because the bus center is like right here in the heart of downtown, it would only make sense to put the Power Teen Center up here, where a lot of things are going on, a lot of like drug-related activities going on downtown, a lot of illegal activities going on, a lot of people in need, and a lot of people coming in and out.
Power does not have data on how many young people they pull out of trouble, and that's on purpose. They don't ask for IDs from clients or do any kind of tracking because they know that for one reason or another, some of them do not want to be found. But Mortensen and Kalizia both say they see the center making a huge difference in the lives of the young people it serves. Kalizia knows what many of the clients face. She ran away when she was 14 and her family was homeless.
I didn't run away from home because it wasn't a home. But when I ran off to the Covenant House, they immediately contacted my mother and she knew where I was and she put me in a girl's home.
She actually liked the stability at the girl's home, but then her mother pulled her out.
And so I was back on the streets, being homeless again. And if Power wasn't here, you know, I don't know where I would have gone because I obviously can't go to Covenant House. They're going to turn my ass in again. So I don't know. I don't really know. I think it's really a blessing because I probably would have been doing some of the stuff that the clients here at Power are doing that are getting really deep into.
Still, hers is a happy story. In the fall, Kalizia is starting college.
Yeah, so I'm going to go off to University of Hawaii, Manoa, and major in gender studies. Really, it's peace studies. Because I really want to be, you know, Power has opened that door for me to be an advocate, a leader in my community.
You can maybe hear it in her voice, but this kind of work is a double-edged sword for Kalizia. It makes her laugh, gives her a sense of purpose, but it's exhausting, and she's had to leave the job 3 times to give herself breathing room. She can tell she's approaching burnout. She's not even legally an adult. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
To see more stories in our series The Blind Spot, visit alaskapublic.org. A years-long effort to bring geothermal power to Unalaska may be on its last legs. The city government is draining its accounts for exploring Makushan Volcano, saying the project is too expensive and risky. The private trust that owns the resource disagrees. KUCB's Annie Ropeek reports.
Unalaska has been trying for 3 decades to find an affordable way to build a geothermal power plant for the city at Makushan Volcano, but it's never gotten off the ground.
Right now, it's just pretty much a dead project.
Unalaska Public Utilities Director Dan Winters says the city is clearing out its geothermal savings. They've transferred an expiring federal grant to Accutan and rolled their local match back into the city's general fund. And soon the state legislature will likely take back the rest of the geothermal account, a $1.5 million grant that was never used. Unalaska wasn't always so disinterested in geothermal exploration. In the 1990s and 2000s, they partnered with the private trust that owns the resource to court developers in the lower 48. They even went together to Iceland to look at geothermal projects there. Trustee Jack Wood wants to see that partnership revived.
I guess all we're looking for is being able to have a fair assessment of where the project is, not just to say the project's a failure.
Once upon a time, all sides agreed that McCushion was a world-class geothermal resource. A test well drilled in the 1980s revealed it could generate enough electricity to heat at least 10,000 homes. Back then, the state of Alaska had control of McCushion, but they stepped back when oil prices crashed. Wood came on as a consultant for the private company that took over the lease. And in the mid-1990s, Wood and a group of investors bought the resource outright.
We formed the Alaska Limited Liability Company called KSLC, or Kagusi Soluta Land Company, and proceeded to undertake bringing in other companies to help develop the project.
Connecting McCushion to Unalaska's electrical grid would require new wells, a power plant, dock, and substations, plus miles of utility lines to stretch across water and rough terrain. All that infrastructure is a big driver of the project's upfront cost, anywhere from $100 million to more than $300 million. Jack Wood says the city of Unalaska wouldn't be expected to pay more than a third of that, but he does need them to sign on as a distributor, selling power to the town's 5,000 residents and shipping companies. Chris Laddick was Unalaska's city manager for 14 years. In that time, Laddick says he and the resource owners could never agree on a financial structure that wouldn't raise electric rates for consumers.
I mean, if it pencils out, it pencils out. And if it doesn't, you've got to be willing to say that it doesn't.
But it did have a major leg up compared to other renewable energy projects in small towns, where figuring out what to do with extra power can be a challenge. Unalaska's seafood processors can use as much electricity as the whole town combined, so much that, for the most part, they make it themselves. Art Aliment is the engineering director for Unice, the city's largest plant.
If somebody knocked on my door and said, hey, we're going to put together a geothermal plant and we want to sell power, if I can buy it cheaper than what I'm making it now, then, you know, that's definitely something we're going to be interested in, and we'll move forward with it. If it's out there available.
But Element says geothermal developers have always wanted firm commitments from the processors to buy a certain amount of power over a certain number of years. The fishing business fluctuates, and Element says they can't make any promises. That meant the city government had to charge ahead to make McCushion viable. But over the years, local support and funding broke down. By the time Chris Laddick left Unalaska to become the state's new commerce commissioner in March, the city was letting go of its McCushion savings and setting its sights back on diesel. That meant buying a fourth generator and new waste heat recovery systems to make the powerhouse sustainable as fuel prices fell. Jack Wood thinks that's short-sighted, but not for the obvious environmental reasons. He says it's about the money, long-term savings for residents and growing industries. But Wood and his group can't do much without a change in leadership. Right now, Unalaska is looking for a new permanent city manager. McCushion trustee Ed Fish says they'll reach out to that person to resurrect the project.
It's going to take a cooperative effort to get this thing done. If there is a city administration and a city council that wants to work towards that end, they will find ready participants in us. And if that doesn't come to pass, well, our kids will end up owning part of a volcano.
For now, though, they'll shop McCushion around to private companies alone and wait for a chance to bring the city back on board. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Two Nome residents are facing felony charges for theft and falsifying business records after allegedly stealing more than $25,000 from Nome Public Schools. Court records show 28-year-old Ashla Marie Weston and 24-year-old Joseph Grubb are charged in three separate thefts allegedly committed from February through December of 2012. Assistant District Attorney Tom Jamgochin said Tuesday only that the alleged victim is the schools. School officials could not provide a total dollar amount missing from the district due to the ongoing investigation. A grand jury indictment filed in Nome court on April 16th remains sealed from public view. A Bethel team is re-envisioning how household water is treated. They hope to build and test a custom gray water recycling system for hauled water systems in western Alaska that could cut steeply the amount of water households need to buy and how much sewage they produce. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
The Dump the Bucket project aims to treat and reuse water in specific parts of the house. Brian Lefferts is Environmental Health and Engineering Director for the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation, which is leading up the project.
In Bethel and in the villages, the most expensive part of that system is paying someone to drive around and haul that water. So we're hoping that by reusing as much of it as possible, we're reducing the number of deliveries and ultimately making water more affordable for people.
He says many families on small haul systems end up rationing the amount of water they use, and they don't get the health benefit of having a good water supply. A gray water treatment system involves routing plumbing such that waste from the toilet and kitchen sink would go to sewage, while water from places like the laundry, shower, and bathroom sink could go to an in-home treatment system.
They would go into a gray water holding tank that would run through a small treatment system in the home with a really fancy biofiltration unit, and then ozonation or UV disinfectant.
The water would not have to go to off-site treatment and could be used several times in the home.
We're trying to achieve actual drinking water standards from that retreated gray water, but we're still going to classify it as gray water and then provide that back into the home for other taps.
The group is raising funds now online to build a prototype and run it in a lab setting for a year. They'll track household water usage and test for bacteria, phosphates, nitrates, and other compounds. They hope to keep the cost of the system to about $10,000, but there would be a certain level of replumbing involved as well. Lefferts says the technology exists for gray water systems, but they need to find exactly how to build a system that works in rural Alaska.
The component that we're putting in would be a commercially available product. We're just putting it together in a way that's never been tried before.
More information is at dumpthebucket.org. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
Of all the traditional seafoods in southeast Alaska, none are more shrouded in myth and genuine risk than clams and mussels. Paralytic shellfish poisoning, or PSP, killed two people in southeast in 2010. For subsistence harvesters, there's been no way to measure the risk of clam digging until now. In part one of a two-part series, KCAW's Emily Kwong reports on a partnership among southeast tribes to create a regional water monitoring program.
In southeast, between Chichagof and Baranoff Islands, there's a waterway called Peril Strait. The name doesn't come from winds ripping through the channel, but from a shocking event that happened in 1799.
A Russian ship came in, and the villagers had gone out and collected a bunch of clams from an area now called Poison Cove.
Jeff Feldpouch is the Resource Protection Director for Sitka Tribe of Alaska. The incident he's describing is the earliest documented case of PSP in the state. After eating the shellfish, 100 Aleut crew members of fur trader Alexander Baranoff died.
They only made it a few miles to the area that's now called Dead Man's Reach.
Eat the wrong clam and you can die on the beach. That's the grim pathology for PSP, which one state publication in 1982 called Alaska Roulette. In order to protect subsistence harvesters, the Sitka tribe decided to invest in the latest science and to look really closely at what the clams themselves are eating.
So it's 10 a.m., it's sunny, it's calm.
Esther Kennedy, who works for STA, is collecting water samples at the Stargavin dock.
I'm going to start a 3-minute timer.
From far away, it looks like she's flying an underwater kite, dragging a net sedately through the water as microscopic creatures called phytoplankton get trapped inside.
Most plankton is just beautiful, and it looks like little Christmas ornaments. And I have no problem with that, but it's a little bit unnerving to be looking at that. Like, how many of those have I swum through in the past?
The vast majority of phytoplankton are totally harmless. But a few of them, particularly of the genus Alexandrium, they look kind of like an acorn under the microscope, produce a chemical called saxitoxin. Saxitoxin is 1,000 times more potent than cyanide. So potent, it's listed as a chemical weapon by the U.S. military. Saxitoxin is what's responsible for PSP.
Sorry. 3 minutes are up, so I just take the net out of the water.
Kennedy will take these drops of water back to the lab and, using a microscope, count what kinds of phytoplankton, toxic or not, are in the water that week.
Here we are living with hundreds of bears that wander through the street and everybody's scared of the clams.
Chris Whitehead joined STA's Resource Protection Department in the fall of 2013. He pitched the idea for a HAB monitoring program to several tribes. The response was instant.
This is kind of the first step, or kind of the poster child, for collaboration on environmental issues.
According to Jeff Feldpouch, 6 other tribes have signed on for the project. Together, they form Southeast Alaska Tribal Toxins Group, or SEAT, with membership from Sitka, Juneau, Yakutat, Petersburg, Klawak, Craig, and Kasan.
Right now, we're just collecting from the Yakutat Lagoon.
That's Matt Anderstrom, who does the water testing for Yakutat Tlingit Tribe. The lab had its first sighting of Alexandrium this spring. That's the one that makes saxitoxin. The tiny piece of plankton was spotted by his younger daughter, Nellie.
She was asking what the bad ones looked like, and as soon as she seen it, she lit up, and there it is right there.
Using the data field workers like Anderstrom and Kennedy are gathering, each tribe hopes to eventually create an early warning system for toxic bloom events in their area. In Sitka, Feldpouch imagines it will be a stoplight, published in the daily paper.
A green should be good to go, a yellow is proceed with caution, and a red we have found saxitoxins out there.
Right now, the Sitka tribe is only testing the waters at Stargavin, and Feldpouch recognizes that may not be enough.
Eventually we may be able to grow and do other areas, but I imagine there's probably 50, 60 beaches around here that people get their shellfish from, and there's no way to cover all those areas.
Each tribe has focused their first year of fieldwork on one site, and for Sitka, the choice of Stargavin is strategic. In 2013, 2 locals suffered mild PSP cases in the middle of October. So the old rule of thumb that safe harvesting months had an R in them, basically September through April, is no longer true. With PSP a threat any time of year, Whitehead believes it's more important than ever for communities to reclaim their beaches and to know exactly what lurks beneath the water. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Matthew Smith in Nome, Annie Ropeek in Unalaska, Ben Matheson in Bethel, and Emily Kwong in Sitka. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. Alaska Children's Trust, working to prevent child abuse and neglect by encouraging all Alaskans to take small steps that can make a big difference in the lives of Alaska's children. Information at alaskachildrenstrust.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Children's Trust.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.